Hello and welcome to the A's Pod episode 3.3, brought to you once again by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. I am joined, as usual, by Dan and Connor. How are you guys doing, Dan?
Doing as well as you can be right now, I guess. Chicago is completely shut down, so I am doing absolutely nothing all the time, besides just thinking and talking about Michigan football, so feeling extremely great.
Yeah, Dan's been doing a lot of getting mad in the group chat about Michigan football, which I don't blame you, man. I want to stay up front. It's cold in Montana. I'm here. I was actually just working on my newsletter. I'll plug that again. A Lonely Impulse of Delight, ConnorRoseSouther.substack.com. It's not about Michigan football. It's about Calvin and Hobbes and stories and nice things. That's what I've been up to.
That sounds so much more pleasant than, well, I guess I've been writing about basketball a fair amount lately, so that's actually been fine. But and I guess the hockey team's good, but don't ask me for details. But anyway, I don't think we're gonna do a long feelings ball segment here, because I don't think our post Wisconsin feelings are very different from our like post Michigan State and post Indiana feelings, except just more so. But we're kind of just resigned at this point to this team as bad, I'm assuming. Connor?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a possibility they could win a couple more games, but, like, I'm not going to bet on it, like, once we get to our pick segment. It's bad. I didn't think we'd sink this low under Harbaugh. I don't know what I can possibly articulate that hasn't been said on the main pod, in articles, certainly all over the MGO board and all over Michigan Twitter. I will just say that, like, I feel bad for the players, because there are a lot of really talented players in this team who will get a chance to play in the NFL, and almost none of them, with a few exceptions, look nearly as good as they should, and that's because they're almost all victims of the way the team is right now, and that's probably the thing that I feel saddest about, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bummer to watch talent get somewhat squandered in this way. Dan, any change in your feeling from Indiana to now, or is it just increased?
I feel actually better than I did last week, because at least there is some clarity at this point that we are no longer waiting for this team to figure it out, that things have come completely off the rails, to the point that there is now like a forced conversation, that there have to be changes made at least on some level. I'll say that like I generally try not to be like I'm not really a vibes guy, contrary to what you've heard on this podcast. I'm not really like, oh, the team's quit. Like, usually, like, I think that saying stuff like that is usually, code for just the team's not very good. You know, when you're saying, oh, the team's quit, they didn't show any fire, they played sloppy. Like, sometimes that's just not being good at football. But I do really feel like this team came out completely defeated, right off the bat. And basically from the second that, that first play, that interception, they just did not compete on any level. It was a repeat of last year's Wisconsin game, but worse, honestly. My feelings haven't really changed. I've become more resolute in my opinion of, what needs to happen with this program. I guess a little bit, like, more optimistic that it could potentially happen, I guess.
And speaking of that, we are now going to cede the floor to Connor for what we have probably determined is most everybody's worst case scenario coming out of this season, which would be if Michigan decided to keep Jim Harbaugh as head coach and just continue moving in that direction, at least for another season. And to say why that might not be the worst thing in the world, or to at least give that case, we are going to try to make it as clear as possible that this is a thought exercise. Connor, take it away.
Yeah, thank you, Ace. I just want to state that, like, you know, we're practicing some sort of Enlightenment era legal principles here. We think everyone deserves a capable defense, even Jim Harbaugh, even that law. And so, while I'm not saying that this is at all my opinion, I'll get into my opinion a little bit more freely later. But I do want to give Jim as robust a defense as I can of why if Michigan does keep him, which still seems possible, by the way, like, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion they're going to fire him by any means. I'll try to explain why, how you can make that case that they shouldn't fire him, or why it might be okay if they didn't. I think it's basically gets into three categories of points for me. Point category number one in his defense would be just excuses, which we all hate these in football, especially football coaches in theory hate excuses. But I mean, the first excuse just being this is COVID season. Michigan fans are at risk of getting a little bit parochial, I think, about our misery being unique when you're in a situation where...
Never.
Michigan fans, parochial, blinkered, never. But I think, you know, defending champion LSU has just been an absolute train wreck on so many levels as a program this year. It's remarkable, honestly. You know, Oklahoma opened the season getting clowned on. Clemson is faltering. You know, Penn State is somehow worse than Michigan thus far, has not won a single solitary game. So, you know, first of all, if ever there was a year for mulligans or to give programs a leeway, it's this year. I think that's really important to keep in mind. Which brings me to, I think we underrate what COVID cost this team. If you add Ambry and Nico into the mix, I do think the team is meaningfully better to such an extent that I think it would have been much harder for Michigan to lose the Michigan State game, which was a nail biter. Even with Michigan just looking disastrous in so many parts of that game. If you throw Ambry out there and he's covering Ricky White or whatever, I think Michigan probably still pulls it out.
Ricky White.
Yeah. The unstoppable Ricky White. You throw Ambry into the mix and you give, you know, Joe another good jump ball target, which is something he needs because, you know, his guys are not winning the kind of difficult throws that he's making. Sometimes ill-advisedly, sometimes, you know, it's the receiver's fault, but, like, he could really use a Nico. So those are big losses. Only in the Big Ten, the only team with comparable like preseason losses was Penn State. And, I mean, look at them, right? And then, you know, this is an injury-ravaged team. I think under more normal circumstances where Michigan is 2-2 and didn't lose to Michigan State, we would say, all right, if you count COVID losses, Michigan is down its, like, five best players right now. That is, obviously, Ambry and Nico were out from the beginning, but then you've got Hutchinson and Pay are out currently, and Jalen Mayfield. And that's just devastating. Those are all, like, the three guys that started the season but are now hurt are, like, all, you know, first or second round picks most likely. Losing them on a team that's already young anyway, like, certainly compared to the Wisconsin team they faced, is just devastating. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, you would give the team excuses if things were a little bit less dire and they were just, like, 2-2 in less embarrassing fashion, right? So, yeah, I mean, I could go on about the excuses, but they do exist, first of all. The somewhat more positive points in Harbaugh's favor, and Dan's going to get just be boiling over as I list these, but you're going to get your chance to yell at me, I promise.
I've been muted on the podcast.
He's holding back.
I'm screaming.
Well, I will say this. Do you guys want to, like, rebut these as, like, entrenches or, like, let me finish my spiel and then do it? I mean,
You should just lay it all out there.
Okay.
Just go for it.
Okay, so then here are the things that are actually going, I think, fairly well and have been going well under Harbaugh and are not totally off the rails yet. Recruiting is going a lot better than a lot of, like, less informed fans think. There are notable gaps. So, like, obviously we see the fruits now of not recruiting cornerback and defensive tackle very well the last few years. But, like, the 2020 young class, aside from losing Rashawn Benny, still looks good. No one's decommitted. You know, they've stolen recruits from places that are truly imploding, like Florida State. There's a lot of studs in that class. And, you know, I think that overall you couldn't really expect, barring structural changes to college football, I don't think anyone is going to do, like, such a tremendously better job than what Harbaugh is doing. I don't think anyone's going to be pulling in, like, top three classes frequently at Michigan unless, you know, the money cannon is allowed to be unleashed fully and players are getting paid openly. I think that recruiting, you know, there are a lot of good things about recruiting, and yes, we're seeing the fruits of notable gaps. And for whatever reason, Michigan has momentum right now with some serious studs. I don't claim to understand this, but, like, there is momentum with Sierra Wright, who's a big-time top 100 cornerback of the athletic variety, I promise you, in 2021, he would be a great get. And then Domani Jackson and Will Johnson, who are both five stars, who said they're probably a package deal. They were at that Wisconsin game and like somehow came away liking Michigan more with like crystal ball buzz. I think, you know,
well, the playing time's there for them because they're both cornerbacks too.
I mean, these are juniors in high school who would play now for Michigan.
Most likely, yes.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are studs, right? They're, you know, there's some good trends for Michigan recruiting, believe it or not. And this is a little more controversial, and I think this is probably one of the least defensible points I have. But I do think that Harbaugh is capable of going out and finding some good assistants. Like, Brown at the time was a great hire, and he was a great coordinator early on in his tenure at Michigan. Truly, truly great coordinator early on in his tenure at Michigan. You know, like, Warner was a great hire. I think there are other guys on staff I want to keep, like Sharon Moore, you know, hopefully if there were a transition. I think that if the assumption is that Harbaugh is going to promise Ward that he's going to clean house, like, I think Michigan has the resources and Harbaugh has the wherewithal to make some good hires. And I know that's debatable because some hires that he's made recently haven't worked out. But I'll just say that. Some other stuff I'm going to skip over for now, but I will land on this. I think category three is kind of like why coaching transitions are tricky. They suck. Coaching transitions suck. You lose recruits. Guys transfer. The new coach has to win guys over. You know, Harbaugh's floor has fallen out. There's a decent chance that floor comes back next year, especially with an improved staff. And we might really miss that floor when, like, you know, Chris Kleeman is going 6-6 and getting boat raced by Maryland or whatever is happening in a potential transition year. And we'll also miss a lot of guys that'll probably decommit, et cetera, et cetera. And speaking of Kleeman, I think this is the hardest thing for Michigan fans to swallow right now. There is no slam dunk hire. By which I mean, I'm not saying that there are no good coaches Michigan could possibly get. I'm saying that there's no, by slam dunks, I mean, like, you're not getting Saban, Dabo. You're probably not getting Urban. I mean, we can have that conversation.
It's not happening.
Yeah, it's not happening. I find it very unlikely. And then there's no one. So let's think about what Harbaugh was. Harbaugh was a guy who completed one of the best turnarounds in, you know, the modern era of college football at Stanford, then took a team to a Super Bowl in the NFL. There's no one of that caliber that Michigan's going to get. They're not going to get, like, John Harbaugh from the NFL. They're not going to get anybody, you know, they're not going to get anybody who's a star in the NFL currently, which was what Harbaugh was. There's no one even close to that resume that Michigan could get as a slam dunk. So that is something to be considered. And with that, I will let Dan finally yell at me after that long spiel.
Oh, Connor. I mean, yeah. So I guess I'll take it point by point here. So as far as COVID season goes, look, there have been injuries on this team, and we can talk about that in the next point. I'll say that the COVID part of things has not affected Michigan at all. The only thing COVID got Michigan was an extended off season, so they could, you know, ostensibly evaluate these players and realize that they had, you know, nobody that could run a 4-6 in the secondary, but they chose to not do that. So, you know, we had some opt-outs in terms of players missing, but all this staff had was more time to evaluate the talent on this roster. So I just don't really buy the COVID end of things. They haven't even had, like, a stoppage. I mean, maybe there have been some players out here or there, but I, you know, I don't think that this is the product that we were going to get, whether or not there was, you know, whether or not there was a pandemic, you know, I mean, plus or minus a couple of players. From a personnel perspective, you know, I mean, I'll grant you that Ambry and Nico, and, you know, the injuries they've had are huge. There's just absolutely nobody, there's absolutely nobody that, you know, they got hurt on all the areas they couldn't afford to get hurt on. So, you know, I mean, I'll grant you that point, really. The thing that I'll say, though, is, like, the fact that there's nobody to step in for Ambry, you know, and there's kind of nobody to step, I mean, I don't know. From Nico, Hutchinson, Pye, Mayfield, those are all kind of situations where you were sort of screwed if they went down, because you had to put in someone that hadn't really played before. But for Ambry, at least, I will say that the fact that there's nobody to step in for him is a recruiting issue, and it's something that this coaching staff must have known, or should have seen. So the fact that we were relying so heavily on Ambry to, you know, be that stopgap so that, you know, the corners could not suck for one more year, is an indictment of this staff. And then moving on to, you know, the incredibly young team. I mean, look, this is a quote-unquote young team. And on offense, I will give you that the offense is probably going to improve next year. But this team is not necessarily going to improve next year. There are a lot of talent right now that is going to be graduating next year that is going to leave Michigan's defense specifically in a really tough spot. You know, Hutchinson and Paye are gone next year, who were really the only thing like keeping this defense, you know, afloat while they were healthy. So like that defense you saw against Wisconsin is probably going to be what the defense. I mean, look, hopefully they have a new coordinator, whatever. In the scenario that Harbaugh stays, I assume they still replace Brown. But it's probably not going to be quite as bad as we saw against Wisconsin. But it's going to be far less talented, you know, without Paye and Hutchinson. So, you know, I guess you make some valid points there, but it's also not totally about this specific weird COVID season. This is more of like a trend and a long-term, you know, trajectory of the program. So I'll give you some time to, you know, counter argument there.
That's very gracious of you. No, I think that's all valid. I mean, I'm really frustrated about just the fact that there are so many talented players in this team, and everything that they're trying to do is undercut by the fact that there aren't cornerbacks who can run fast enough, for instance. And like, I don't think that you and I actually disagree that much about a lot of these points. These are more points that, like, if you wanted to say construct a case why the team might get better next year, the main caveat would not so much be like even the players getting older as it would be like, all right, hopefully the team with a better staff will eval itself correctly and game plan correctly, at least better than the dismal, abject level they did it this offseason. And I think your trump card in this point is like, why should we believe that a Jim Harbaugh-led staff is going to do that, you know, going into year seven? My kind of argument is just like, you hope that cleaning staff in a more, you know, in a more normal year makes them, these guys, better and makes guys that we know can play and are not being, having a chance to show that can play better. You know, I get being skeptical of that.
I don't want this to run too much longer also, so we don't lose all our listeners before we even reach segment two. One thing we haven't mentioned is that you have to do something about Harbaugh's contract status if you're going to keep him on for another year, because you can't have a coach coaching on an expiring deal. It's just, it's not how it works. It would completely tank recruiting. And so at least on its face, you have to pretend to commit to him for 2 to 3 more years at least, with a buyout in there to convince guys to come aboard. And at that point, with so many of the other arguments for him staying on generally just being arguments against making any coaching change at any point, I know this is more a hypothetical exercise than anything else, but I just have a hard time with the keep Harbaugh arguments, even though there's definitely some validity, especially with some of the recruiting stuff that he's done. But that might hit a hard wall if they can't do something about his contract.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Just from a you know, like a logical perspective, if you're thinking about being the AD, like, I think it makes more sense to, you know, you can say fire, you can say amicably separate, whatever, you know, whoever wants to say they broke up with who works for me. but, you know, it makes more sense to let him go than to keep him on. He's, you know, he costs a lot, and I know that money's fake for this athletic department, but it's not nothing, and they could probably get someone who'd do a better job for cheaper. And this is the perfect time with 1 year left on his deal for them to let him go. So I would just address the a couple of the other points that Connor made. You know, I agree that recruiting is going well. on a macro level, but there are still not defensive tackles or cornerbacks in this 21 class. And that is like an artifact of this Don Brown coaching, you know, this Don Brown's recruiting, you know, strategy. And that doesn't seem like it's going to get better in the 21 class. Maybe if they get Sayre Wright. And it's just had, like, you know, Harbaugh takes the reins from a defensive recruiting perspective. You know, we'll see. And then, you know, I think the last thing I would say is that a conversation for keeping Harbaugh, for me, has to start with these, you know, a couple of things. One, win the next three games and look genuinely improved. So that's Maryland, Rutgers, Penn State. Like, have to win. I would say even have to win relatively comfortably against three bad teams and have to look like they are making a genuine midseason improvement and not just kind of stumbling through and winning by a couple points. And then it's being competitive with Ohio State for a half, which is such a low bar. But I mean, that's what it's going to take. Like, if they come out, if they win the next three games and come out against Ohio State and just get blown out like they just did against Wisconsin, like, I'm not even talking about it. It's not, like, I'm not obviously not making the decision, but, like, my personal opinion, like, I would just not, it's not worth it. What's the point? That's three straight years, and it's, you know, four out of six that we've just, like, not been competitive. So, you know, what are we doing here?
We're going to talk you down to a quarter by the end of the season. Competitive quarter.
I'm standing strong at a half. I will not take a quarter.
Two possessions.
Yeah, a series is where we're going to end up.
from there, I would say then in the off season, it's like totally giving Gattis the reins to the offense. I know we don't know what Gattis is, but clearly there's some meddling with Harbaugh, and he's got to realize after this that, you know, there has to be, he has to take his hands out of the offensive, you know, side of things.
Well, and they also need to be able to evaluate Gattis before the end of the season.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, I guess, honestly, part of it is going to be giving Gattis the keys to the offense, like, you know, now. And at least seeing what we've got there, because I think we still don't know what's going on. And then I would say it's in the offseason, it's like a totally, totally restructured defensive staff. I mean, I am of the mind at this point that I do feel like Don Brown has been given total autonomy over hires and recruiting on this defensive, you know, the defensive side of the ball and the defensive staff. And, you know, quite frankly, he's done a lot of good things. He's been an elite coordinator, you know, at least for the first, like, 3 years of his tenure. But honestly, like, he's kind of screwed over the defensive side of the ball. We've got a ton of coaches right now in Zordich and Shoup, who's not even with the team, and Jean-Marie, that are, like, not known as recruiters and, you know, don't seem to be doing much teaching zone that we all thought they were going to do. And then you've got a guy in Nua who has been a total disappointment. And then you've got Don Brown, who is clearly thought that he could just get away with, you know, playing man for the millionth season in a row. So, you know, I mean, I want a clean house on the defensive side of the ball. It's got to be, you know, a whole overhaul. So those are my stipulations for, like, where the debate starts.
Yeah, I mean, look, as the person tasked with defending Harbaugh, I think there's no defense of Harbaugh that doesn't say exactly what you just said, which is essentially clean house on the defensive side of the ball. Brown has to go, and almost all the position coaches absolutely have to go. The only guy I'm wondering about is Gene Mary. I know linebackers have been bad in games. He is doing a good job as a recruiter, though. I will say that. Their linebacker class next year, which I think he has a major hand in, is looking good. But again, that's, like, the one person I would be willing to debate. Nua,
if we're getting into micro defenses of position coaches at this point, it's probably time to move on.
Sorry, Ace. I just wanted to say, like, there's no defense of Harbaugh where it's like, it's not like he has to promise to clean everything and do, like, full penance and, you know, just that's all I wanted to convey. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, and at that point, you wonder, why not just clean house entirely? But it could get a little messy. But in case they do clean house entirely, which I think we are still hoping for, we are going to continue our discussion of coaching candidates on the other side of this break.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing.
When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com.
Reasons to quit. The low is always lower than the high. And the reasons to quit don't outnumber all the reasons why. So we keep smoking.
People liked our Matt Campbell segment so much last week that we figured we should probably cover some other coaching candidates in similar detail. We're going to do kind of a higher end and a lower end option this week, even though we already really covered the low end option in the first segment. But we're going to start by discussing Luke Fickell of Cincinnati. And, you know, previously interim at Ohio State and previously just a Buckeye for life before that. And conclude with a hopefully pretty brief conversation about pulling the ripcord on Harbaugh but wanting to maintain some continuity and therefore promoting Josh Gattis to head coach. But let's start with Fickell, who has coached Cincinnati to a 7-0 start this year. They are legitimately in the playoff conversation. They have won 11 games in each of the past two seasons after he took over a pretty moribund program from Tommy Tuberville, who has a way of leaving teams in a certain state. Fickell has also raised their recruiting profile pretty significantly from where they were under Tuberville. Including kind of working his way into Michigan State's territory a little bit. But the big issue might be just, is this a fit? Both from whether Michigan wants to pursue Fickell and from whether Fickell wants to take the job. Dan, what do you think about whether you'd want Fickell and whether Fickell would come?
Look. From a coaching perspective, there's no case against Fickell. He's a Midwest guy. He's recruited Ohio. I mean, I can't tell you, for a long time Red Cedar message board reader, they hate Cincinnati right now because he's taking all their recruits. And it was more before Mel Tucker, but that's neither here nor there. He's raised their recruiting profile. I would say, like, pretty much since the time that he was interim head coach for a year in 2011. He's been an arrow straight up, 2012 to 2016, the leader of, those Ohio State defenses. It got a lot of talent to work with there, but he was legitimately great. And I would say that the defenses at Ohio State fell off after he left in 2016. We all remember the 2016 defense that, we played, which is a great defense. And in 2017, they had a in 2017 and in 2018. 2017 started to show some cracks, and 2018 was like an outright bad defense somehow at Ohio State. So, I mean, like, that's something you want to look for in a, you know, coordinator, is something where they fall off after he leaves. And then from 2017 to 2020 at Cincinnati, it's been just a complete arrow straight up, and they are legitimately very good. So, I mean, my answer to whether I would want Fickell, I got to say, with all my misgivings about, you know, him being an Ohio State guy, I think if he was willing to come, which it doesn't seem like he would be, but let's just for the sake of argument say he is, I think it's one of those, like, you can't say no. I would say, like, my ultimate fear is that we would hire him as head coach, and the Ohio State job opens up, and he leaves Michigan to go to Ohio State, which I know is, like, such, like, a far in the future, like, weird scenario, but that would be just, that would be, like, shut down the program level, like, getting owned. I mean, you know, the only downside here is, like, he played at Ohio State, he was an Ohio State graduate assistant, and then he coached at Ohio State in some form from 2002 to 2016. And then went to Cincinnati, to get away from home, like an hour down the road. so like, I mean, this is a diehard Ohio State guy. The reason that Michigan State wanted him so bad is because he hated Michigan so much. I don't see it happening. I don't think he would come. I think he's gonna wait for Notre Dame or Ohio State to open up. But I think if he would, you know, if you can say, hey, we're gonna back up the Brinks truck, then you got to take him because he's the best coach on the board right now.
Yeah, and speaking of backing up the Brinks truck, I think it is worth noting that his salary is in the, like, $3.5 million range, and that's the one thing that kind of gives me some belief that Michigan could pull him away from Cincinnati is, you know, it's hard to wait on the Ohio State job right now with Ryan Day there because Ryan Day, I believe, is younger than Luke Fickell. And Brian Kelly is having enough success in Notre Dame that unless you're hoping he kind of unexpectedly retires soon, there's still going to be a relatively extended wait for that. And then you ask, do you want to keep kind of topping out, like, because this season is going to be as good as it gets at Cincinnati. Literally, this right now, their SP Plus rating is the best in program history, if it holds. And that is coming 3 years after their worst SP Plus finish since 2005. There's only so much you can keep rocketing up before you start to taper off a bit. And Cincinnati in the college football playoff is about as high as you're going to get. And that's on the table this year, and it's still probably, if I had to guess, more unlikely than likely. So I think the case for Michigan is it's the most elite Midwest job that's going to come up this soon. Whether that's enough to get him is still in some question, but if you can, I think you have to do it. Connor, you're the vibes guy, and I know you were feeling some bad vibes about this.
Yeah.
Do you have a dissenting opinion?
I mean, the vibes thing we've covered, I do think it's just deeply weird to coach with a bucknut over your heart, like it's a religious emblem. You're not even the coach at Ohio State. I mean, that's strange behavior. You know, like, the thing about football coaches, of course, is that they're all, shall we say, mentally extreme individuals, at least the good ones are. And that partly means that you can probably, many coaches at least, could, like, convince themselves, you know, to have a passionate hatred for a team they used to love if it means winning and whatever other coach stuff they value. So, you know, the vibe stuff, I'll try not to worry about too much. I will say that, like, I prefer vibes of people who aren't, you know, just ensconced in Ohio State. The only thing I'll say about Fickell is this. Sometimes there's a little bit of fool's gold with group of five guys who, you know, win 11 games in their, you know, crappy conference in a down year. And like Scott Frost, for instance. And then when they have to go up against the Death Star in the Power Five and they're playing like six teams a year that are better than everyone they faced, in their old conference, things get a little bit tighter. And that's one reason why a guy like Campbell, who I know we all love, goes without saying, like, that's why, you know, someone who's gone up against the Death Star, played way more talented teams week in, week out, and gotten results, to me, has a slight edge over group of five guys who, you know, have a magical run through what is probably not a very good conference. But that's a pretty tenuous reason to go against someone who also has, you know, high-level coordinator experience and one of the best programs there is. So,
I mean, I do think it's legitimate, though, especially since his coordinator experience is on the defensive side of the ball. And I think we've said previously how we kind of prefer an offensive mind if you have to choose between the two. And there is something to be said about the possibility that Fickell has turned around Cincinnati by, you know, first of all, just installing a level of competence that wasn't there under Tommy Tuberville, and also just kind of overwhelming the AAC with talent. You know, like we've been discussing, he's taking the guys that Michigan State has been going after. And when you're doing that in the American Conference, you're going to win a lot of games if you just don't screw up the coaching schematic side of it.
Yeah. If you coach better than Michigan has this year, essentially.
Yes. So I do worry a little bit about once the talent gets to a point where you're going to be at a deficit on occasion, and most of the teams you're playing against are going to at least be closer to you and have, and everybody's going to have some NFL players on their roster. I do wonder if he has a bit harder of a ceiling than what is currently perceived, but the floor for him seems pretty, like, very high at this point. So, and considering Michigan needs to restore a floor under this program, that sounds pretty nice at this point.
Yeah, and I'll just quickly counter those worries a little bit. I would say that I think Luke Fickell has demonstrated that he clearly he's been at Ohio State, and we've seen what he's done at Cincinnati. This is a man that understands you need to recruit at an elite level to have elite success. And this is a man who is on a staff, you know, with Urban Meyer, who's one of the great offensive minds in the game. This is a man that understands that you can't just win defensively. So I think while he's a defensive guy, and while he's been overwhelming the AAC with talent, I think that he would understand, like, he understands levels of talent. Do you know what I mean? And I think it wouldn't be a major issue, worry for me. And like I said, I think if he's willing to come, you have to do it.
Yeah, the arguments against Fickell are also compliments to Fickell. So, which is that he can't be so choosy that he would turn down Michigan, and that he has maybe done too good at recruiting at Cincinnati for us to be able to judge his schemes. So yeah, he sounds like, yeah, you gotta give him a call. You gotta fire the cannon his way. You got to put a contract in front of him that at least makes him think about where his true loyalties lie. But, yeah, we'll see. I mean, he might actually have the cachet to turn it down and wait, like he did with Michigan State. So it'd be a bit of a gut punch to get put in the Michigan State category. But honestly, we kind of deserve it at this point. And speaking of kind of a Sparty move, if on the other end of the spectrum Michigan can't get a guy like Fickell or Campbell or Mario Cristobal, who we will eventually cover, or, you know, a litany of other names that have come up, and decide they want to go for some continuity, you know, decide they need to move from Harbaugh, what is there a chance that Josh Gattis as a head coach could work out? I don't even remember who suggested this as the as a potential topic. Speak for yourself.
I think this was kind of a group chat, just emergent idea.
That's fair. It just grew out of misery and general chatting.
I will briefly say this for Josh Gattis, points in his favor. He's very good at evaling and then going and getting extremely fast receivers. Like, I know no one on Michigan's team looks great right now, but I'm really happy they got Roman Wilson. I think if Xavier Worthy does make it to campus, he's a truly special talent, and that's 100% Gattis. You know, I think he's very good at going out and finding guys that he wants in his offense and getting them, and he's been a part of some really good recruiting operations, most notably at Alabama. And I think that you could talk me into him if, like, you could talk me into him as, like, not the worst option possible, I should say. You know, if he manages to stage a rescue of his own offense, if, like, we see a turnaround where this offense looks coherent, gets some results, we're able to say what his offense is, and, you know, there's, like, recruiting momentum and buzz around it. You know, Gattis can prove to me that he is a good OC. I don't think that's totally out of the question yet. I will say that this offense currently is a very, very long way from making me feel like we would be in okay hands with him as head coach.
Yeah, I mean, like, the way I look at this is, like, how would we look at it if this was a hire from the outside? If this guy was coaching at, I don't know, let's just say Tennessee, and had similar offenses, you know, I mean, like, what, the 15th rank SP Plus offense last year, which is pretty good, and then, you know, this dumpster fire, and then we hired him as head coach, we would all be, and, you know, he's, like, 35 years old or whatever, like, we would all rightfully be extremely worried about that hire. You know, I think that the prerequisite for me would be that, you know, we clearly see a point right now where Harbaugh gives him the reins and the offense immediately looks much, much better. And then we go, and then, you know, I don't even know what the mechanism would be by which he, you know, becomes the head coach. But whatever happens, I guess they strike out entirely with all their options, and he's kind of given, like, an interim, like, you know, $2 million a year salary for the next, like, 3 years with, like, a low buyout or whatever it is. And I guess, you know, hires, like, a gangbusters recruiting staff. So, you know, that's like your... It would almost be like what Ohio State did with Luke Fickle in 2011, where it's like, all right, I mean, you know, we kind of struck out on our top targets. Let's just see what this kid can do, you know? So, like, it wouldn't be, like, program-endingly bad, but I wouldn't think it would... I wouldn't be optimistic. Like, I'd probably be going into next season saying, like, all right, like, let's see what happens here, but... let's also see, you know, what the coaching carousel looks like in 2022. That's basically where I would be at.
Yeah, the upside is mostly in that he would be cheap and easy to get out of relative to other options. He has been exposed to the Alabama recruiting machine, so hopefully, you know, he can start modernizing Michigan's recruiting approach if he's in charge of that, because it is in need of some organization and updating. And I mean, yeah, like, we'd have to see what his offense looks like, hopefully before the end of this season, without what seems to be some obvious Harbaugh meddling. And even then, it's hard to not feel somewhat underwhelmed by that hire, but it is, as we've kind of said, probably the worst case scenario, maybe even compared to just letting Harbaugh ride for another year. So that's the floor, and even the floor has a little bit of upside to it. So I actually have a decent amount of optimism about this coaching search, even though there isn't necessarily a home run candidate, because there are some decent candidates out there, and at least there are some young guys if Michigan is willing to go in that direction. And that's really where my biggest concern is what Michigan is willing to do compared to what they've done in the past. But that's another conversation for another week's podcast. We are going to take another quick break, turn back around, and hit you with our Big Ten picks for this weekend. All right, we have another Friday night game to kick off this week's Big Ten slate. I accidentally put this backwards when I initially wrote out the picks for this week, which is appropriate. But right now it is Purdue at Minnesota. Purdue is favored by 3. The over-under is 62.5. This, surprisingly to me, opened as a pick'em. With Purdue and Minnesota just straight up even, and the over under at 65.5. Dan, who you got in this one?
So not even because, you know, I'm not gonna do my usual talk about my girlfriend bit, but I actually think, I mean, Minnesota just sucks. They looked good against Maryland a little, like, offensively, and I don't know what to take from that, but. Look, we know we suck now, and Minnesota got pasted by us. And Purdue has looked competent. Like, I do think, I mean, Jeff Brohm is actually someone I'd want to talk about coaching search-wise. I know that might not be the most popular take, but every time I watch his teams, they're very competent. I'll take Purdue to cover here. And I'll take the over, I suppose. Because Minnesota's defense is horrendous, and I think Purdue will score like 40 on their own.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have anything truly insightful to add there. I'm definitely taking the over for the reasons that Dan enumerated. Minnesota, like, I kind of don't want to do exactly what Dan did, but I feel like from a gambling perspective, because I am doing okay this year on picks, I'm going to do the same thing. Yeah, Purdue to cover and taking the over, just because he's right. Like, Minnesota is just terrible. That's the reality.
Yeah, I the only reason I'd go against these picks is to be contrarian, and I don't care about being contrarian in a Purdue-Minnesota game. So, yeah, I, for the same reasons that Dan said, Purdue to cover and the over. Because I do think Minnesota has found a little bit of offensive juice, too. It's just their defense is so bad that I expect Purdue to cover that spread. Next game, Michigan State at Maryland. Maryland is favored by 6. The over-under is 55. Maryland opened as a 3-point favorite, so that line has moved 3 points in their direction since it opened. Dan, who you got for that one?
So I'm going to go off on a little bit of a tangent here. I just want to say that I'm so pissed that Michigan, that this awful Michigan team couldn't beat this Michigan State team. Guys, this team sucks so bad. they are so, so bad. And if Michigan could have just won by 3, I don't even care how they won, I would be enjoying the season so much more. Now, I just got back into hate listening Michigan State podcasts, and every time, like, it gives them a spark of hope. They could be so much more miserable right now if they just hadn't beaten Michigan. Like, they're already miserable, and they think the team sucks, and they're kind of losing faith in this new coaching staff. But they're hanging their hat on beating Michigan, and rightfully so. That's a great moment for a first coaching, you know, for a first year coaching staff. And it just pisses me so off that we couldn't figure this out and just tape and you know, gum, like, and duct tape together, like, enough offense to beat this terrible team. So with all that said, Maryland is going to cover because, you know, Maryland's defense seems like it's very bad. But it doesn't matter against Michigan State because Maryland will watch film and realize that, you know, Rocky Lombardi or Peyton Thorne cannot throw downfield. Michigan State has an offense at the level where it doesn't matter how bad the defense is. Like, it's still a rock. Like, you don't have to do anything against it. So Maryland covers, and I'm going to take the under, which is pretty horrendous. But Michigan State does still have a pretty good defense. They'll probably hold Maryland to like under 30, and Michigan State will score like 10. So I'll take Maryland under.
Yeah, I'm with you. Michigan State is just completely abject. Lombardi got benched last game. Maryland's going to whoop them. You know, 6 is I think far too low of a line here. And I'm going to take, I'm also going to take the under. I expect a wretched game, but I also expect Maryland to romp, and I think Michigan State's going to score like 10 points. So
I am actually going to go contrarian and not just for the sake of it here, which is Maryland. Well, I'm torn because Maryland has been lucky in the turnover and yardage department, but also Michigan State is a team that tends to give other teams some luck in the turnover and yardage department. But with 6 points to cover with two teams that I just, neither of them I think are very good and could turn in a dud pretty much at any time, I'm actually going to pick Michigan State to cover this spread. I do agree it's going to be ugly, so I am going to stick with the under. Next game on our schedule is Indiana at Ohio State. Sorry to those who are really hoping for an Indiana appearance in the Big Ten title game, but the Buckeyes are favored by 20.5 in this one after opening as 21-point favorites. The over-under is 65. Dan, do you think the Buckeyes can cover a 3-touchdown spread?
I don't know. I think Ohio State's definitely going to win this game. I think Indiana... weirdly, like, I mean, look, great story. We all rooting for Indiana, obviously. But they don't have any good wins because every team that they've beaten has ended up, you know, sucking. I don't know. I'll say Indiana covers because it's like a lot of points, and it feels like a lot of points has been good this year. And Ohio State isn't like rock solid on defense. But I think Ohio State wins easily still. So Indiana covers, and I'll go with the over because I think, you know, Ohio State's offense is basically unstoppable. And if Indiana scores like 20, Ohio State's going to score like into the 40s. So I will take the over, and I will take Indiana to cover the spread but not win.
Yeah, I think Indiana covers. I actually expect this game to look pretty competitive heading into the half at least. I don't really believe in Ohio State's defense, you know, in relative terms. And I think I'm taking the over because, yeah, I think this will be kind of a shootout, especially early on.
I am not expecting Indiana to keep up. I cannot help but look back at their first game box score in which they gained 211 yards against what has been revealed to be a bad Penn State team in a game that went to overtime. And they gave up 488 in that game. I think when they go up against a team of Ohio State's talent, that Ohio State is going to be able to open it up on them a little bit. And I hate everything I just said, and I hope I'm wrong. Next game is also embarrassing because it's the Big Ten. Illinois at Nebraska. Nebraska is favored by 15.5. Total for this one, 59.5. This opened with Nebraska favored by 14 and the total at 61.5. So not only has the spread opened up a little bit in favor of Nebraska, but it's because people think Nebraska's defense is going to shut down Illinois more than Vegas did initially. Dan, do you agree?
Yeah, kind of. So I think Nebraska wins this game. Nebraska silently has kind of found something in Luke McCaffrey. Wish we had one of those nice McCaffrey boys. I think they've silently found something in Luke McCaffrey. I think they'll win relatively easily. Illinois sucks, and they're basically running a wildcat right now. I'm not sure if Brandon Peters is coming back or not this week. But 15 points is still kind of a lot. So I'll say that Illinois will cover and Nebraska will win, and it will go under. I don't know. I'm trying to take more points because I feel like the teams have just not been covering as big favorites this year.
Yeah, I have a couple principles as a gambling man here. One is that I'm never taking a Scott Frost team that's favored by 50.5 points. Are you kidding me? I know Illinois is terrible. I get that. But, like, no. I think Illinois is going to cover because I still think Nebraska's bad, to be frank. I'll take the under. I think it's going to be just a hideous game. I think Dan and I have agreed on every single one yet, but, you know, that's just because we're both brain geniuses.
Yeah, no, you guys have been in lockstep so far, and that turns me into the contrarian once again just because I think Illinois is actually, like, really, really bad. And Nebraska has at least shown some competence. They did kind of hang with Ohio State for a little bit. They are coming off a win against Penn State where, as Dan mentioned, they may have found something at quarterback. They weren't blown out by Northwestern, which I think would happen to Illinois. I think given that Nebraska is still finding their footing, they're not going to take their foot off the gas if they start to run up a lead. So I think even if this is a close game for a while, Nebraska can turn this into a blowout late and eventually cover. So I will actually take Nebraska and the over. And I'm either going to come out with a shiny record on this one or lose a lot of ground to you two. Our next one up is the de facto Big Ten West championship game. Wisconsin is favored by 7.5 at Northwestern with an over-under all the way down at 45.5. The Badgers opened at 8-point favorites. The total actually opened at 42.5. So Vegas really thinks this is going to be a pretty, we'll call it a pretty Big Ten football game. Dan, do you think the Wildcats can spring the surprise here?
You know, they've done it before, right? I think Wisconsin has looked really good, but they've beaten up on an Illinois. Jeez, what the hell? They've beaten up on an Illinois team that absolutely sucks, and sucked even more in week one than they suck now. And a Michigan team that, I mean, came out completely dead. And looks just generally, I mean, is bad, and then on top of that came out incredibly dead. And also turned the ball over a lot. So I still don't know. You know, Wisconsin's still missing a lot of players. I would say we know more about Northwestern than we know about Wisconsin. I think this game looks so weird to me. I don't understand why the over-under is so low. So I'm definitely going to take the over just because I feel like both teams have competent offenses. And I'll take Northwestern to cover, like a backdoor cover. Like they'll score a touchdown late, with like less than a minute on the clock to, you know, keep it within a score. I think Wisconsin wins this game, but I'll say Northwestern covers and you know, they hit the over.
All right,
yeah.
Connor?
Yeah, so... I am sticking with my guns on this one. I am not going to abandon the Mike Bajakian revolution. May he reign 1,000 years. I still say Northwestern Rose Bowl soon come, and they're going to beat Wisconsin and thus explode this Wisconsin favored by a touchdown business. And this game is going to go to the over because these offenses are a lot better than Vegas seems to think. That is a weird over-under.
So here's my thinking. I think Northwestern's offense is much as the Bajakian Revolution both pleases me and has really taken them to a different level than what Mick McCall was putting out there. They still really lack offensive talent. And Wisconsin, I was kind of surprised at the number of players they had available for the Michigan game. So I'm inclined to think Wisconsin actually ends up turning this into a relatively comfortable win, and also one where they just kind of, where this is a mostly ground-based game where the teams are each trying to choke the life out of each other, and, you know, kind of a classic Wisconsin victory. So I'm going to take Wisconsin and the under and continue the trend of going totally contrarian and hopefully not completely submarining my record.
I actually will agree with you real quick that this is like the perfect offense for Wisconsin to totally shut down. Like just playing that sound football and, you know, putting pressure on this, you know, overwhelmed probably Northwestern offensive line, And kind of forcing Peyton Ramsey into some bad throws, and like just, you know, being able to totally dominate these receivers. You could have something there. I might be, if we talk about this for a little bit longer, I'd be tempted to, you know, change my pick.
Yeah, and that total ticking up 3 points gives me just enough room to feel comfortable taking the under there too.
Soon come. Sorry.
Yes, soon come. I did get burned by them last week picking against it, so, you know, expect that to continue. Iowa -2.5 at Penn State. Boy, Penn State has dropped off. That has a total of 47. This game opened as a pick'em with a total of 45.5. So public opinion clearly favors Iowa. Dan, do you also favor Iowa?
No, I'm gonna continue my trying to hit on betting on either Penn State or Nebraska trend, which has totally blown up in my face, especially last week where I went a horrendous 1-5 on picks. I'm taking Penn State money line on this one, guys. Penn State sucks. I'm not gonna say Penn State doesn't suck. Sean Clifford has been horrendous, but they should have beaten Indiana like 100%. And they should have beaten Nebraska. And you know, then the other team they played, I guess, was, what, Ohio State and Maryland? I guess the Maryland loss looks bad. I don't have an excuse for that one. I will say, you know, this Iowa team is still pretty bad. They have to go to Penn State. Penn State is due to get, like, a cathartic win of, you know, 15 points or whatever. Give me Penn State money line and give me... God, I don't even want to bet this over-under. Both these offenses suck so bad. It's 47, so give me the over, but I don't feel good about it.
Yeah, I firmly believe that Penn State just sucks. I'm not going to make any excuses for them. If Michigan has to get it in the face from national media, Penn State should too. I think Iowa romps, quite frankly, because they've at least looked competent at points this season, and I'm taking the over.
The most confident thing is... for me is betting the under, actually. These are teams that have played some absolutely hideous games historically. Last year, Penn State won 17-12. These are both teams that are trying to protect their quarterbacks and are probably going to be inclined to keep the ball on the ground and throttle things down a bit, especially if the game stays close and this game is projected to stay close. My only question is whether Penn State really truly sucks or whether it's mostly Sean Clifford being pretty bad so far this season covering up them actually being half decent in terms of, you know, yardage and defense and moving the ball a little bit. I think I will take Penn State. I've now talked myself into it over the last 30 seconds. And I am much more confident in the under because these teams are both offensively gross. Finally, we get to the night game. Hooray. Michigan -9.5 at Rutgers with an over-under of 55. This opened with Michigan favored by 9 and has somehow moved more in their direction. The total was initially 51.5, so people are expecting more points than Vegas did initially. Dan, do you dare take Michigan with the points here? Do you want the Rutgers money line? Where are we at?
Oh, Jesus. This is so bad. look, this is what I'm going to say. Rutgers can shut Michigan down on offense. Rutgers has a decent a defensive front, probably better than Indiana's. Who knows what Michigan's going to be running out there in terms of quarterback. I mean, they're having an open quarterback competition this week. Their offensive line is in shambles. I mean, we've all watched it. I don't need to tell you guys. And Rutgers has a pretty good defensive front, frustratingly led by Michael Dwumfor. That said, they're still bad. They still lost to Illinois last week. I don't know. I guess I'll go with Michigan covering kind of in the same way that I'm going with Penn State covering, that, like, they're sort of due for, like, a dumb cathartic win that's, like, not very convincing, but, you know, it's still a win. I don't know. I don't know if I want Michigan to win this game, but I'll say that they... I'm going to say that they cover because my instinct says to go with with Rutgers, and my instinct has been wrong. I will go with the under. I'll say Michigan wins, like, you know, 20-10 or something disgusting.
So Michigan just got chosen via the Costanza strategy. That's really perfect.
I mean, you know, I hate to be the bad vibes guy after I started the season as the good vibes guy. But here's the thing. Michigan has done nothing in the last 3 weeks to deserve an almost 10-point, to be favored by almost 10 points against Rutgers. They just don't deserve it. And, like, Rutgers is still bad. I have said that I was not going to bet Michigan the rest of the season. I'm certainly not betting them now with that line. I'll take Rutgers to cover. You know, it's certainly not impossible for Michigan to win this game, but, like, they got to show us that they can do it, and they should not be favored by this much. So, yeah, I'm at least not betting on Michigan ever again until they win another game. And I'll take the over just because even though these offenses are both very capable of being awful, I think, like, this will be a game where you're going to see, like, you know, blocked punts and just, like, absolutely stupid things happening that will run up the score. So
I do appreciate the prediction for just a farcical game, because I'm also expecting that. It's also why I'm taking the under. And Rutgers, thank you, Dan, for taking the bullet for Michigan for the rest of us. Because, yeah, I just... Yeah, 9.5 points is a lot when your offense really isn't doing much of anything at the moment except regressing. So, I mean, maybe this is the week that the keys get handed over to Gattis and all of a sudden, you know, like, Michigan just blows the doors off Rutgers. I can totally see that. I think that's more likely than a Rutgers victory. Maybe. Hopefully. Yeah. you know, 9.5 is a lot right now in a game where, you know, the total is only 55. So I'm going to kind of trust Vegas's instincts here and take Rutgers in the under. And we are going to light this segment on fire and run away from it as quickly as possible and into something that has nothing to do with football or even really sports. When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com. So our last segment today is based on a Twitter thread from this morning, because I didn't realize this was going to go in this direction. But I responded to a prompt that goes as follows. What was a fucked up drink you made in college that got you nice and blammoed? I would mix a bunch of $7 rum and some squirt and just drink it all day. It had several names. I referred to it as Sailor's Cement, among other things. It was also just known as Potion. A great prompt. Had to take it because I went to a state school. and also by one of my best friends in college was a longtime bartender at Scorekeepers who would pretty consistently... first of all, he tended to work off days, especially when he initially became a bartender, which meant like Wednesdays and Sundays. So he'd just have us up there and try out new drink recipes on us. Not good for anybody's GPA, but good for collecting stories. And this is a more common drink, but my answer to the prompt... was the Starry Night, which is just half Jägermeister and half Goldschlager. It is just disgustingly sticky, sweet, burning, horrible concoction. But it will get you drunk. And on that note, before we go any further in this segment, I'm going to put in a disclaimer, especially considering some of the recipes that I will read. That contain ingredients that should probably not be consumed by humans. We do not recommend any of this. We certainly do not recommend drinking these as a coping technique for watching a night game against Rutgers that Michigan might actually lose. Don't do any of this, please.
Unless you want to be cool.
Yeah, unless you want to be awesome. But no, for real. Please, I can't get sued. So don't do anything too rash with this. I am going to start just reading off some of the best of these, and then we will get to some of our stories. We will try to keep this brief. God, these are just horrifying. This one from I Am Stefan Zonia on Twitter. He was a member of Box House. If you're familiar with Box House, you know this is going to be horrifying, because that is a not frat house.
that what pretty is Box much, House?
Box House is located on, I think, Hoover. And basically, like, it's they hand down places in the house to, like, trusted friends, and those trusted friends are people who can drink like nobody else on campus. I really don't have another way to describe it. This will give you an idea. From I Am Stefan Zonia, we drank a lot of Monster House, in parentheses, Monster Energy Drink and Canada House Whiskey. I can't undersell how much of this we drank. We literally bought cases of both every week. It was also horrible. We loved it and still drink it when we go back for games. As an added bonus, it's also not a drink per se, but we used to have Nightwish sessions. Nightwish is a Finnish metal opera band. We'd buy Finlandia vodka, enter a dark room in winter with windows open / AC unit on so it was freezing, crank Nightwish. We couldn't stop until we drank the fifth. That gives you some idea of how crazy Box House is, and really does not even, it doesn't even come close, to be honest. Buddy and fellow Ann Arbor local, Louis Bien, wrote in a buddy. He very much won up the Starry Night. He said a buddy mixed Rumpelmann's, Goldschlager, and Jaeger in a glass, stuck a candy cane in it, and called it a jackhammer candy cane. Louis Stock refuses to drink minty alcohol as a result.
These are all just bad. Like, none of this is enjoyable.
No, these are all horrible.
Every fun drink from college was all about, like, And it's just like, man, like, I want to, like, go back in time and tell myself, like, you can just, like, have some beers and get really drunk. Like,
or
no
or just
is,
drink
no
the, learn to drink
you
the
do
liquor.
This.
Just yeah. learn to drink the liquor. Actually, another one from I'm Stefan Sonia because I cannot leave this out. This is actually his initial reply. Was that on his 21st birthday, they invented the MDO, short for the Mexican Dentist Office, which was tequila and peppermint schnapps. And they ordered so many of them that Charlie's put it on the shot menu. I had seen that on that menu and wondered how the hell that could have possibly gotten there. And that is the answer.
Wow.
And then an honorary member of Box House responded to that thread with his own drink. The Goose is Dead. Vodka and Blue Curacao. This is not the last time we'll hear Blue Curacao mentioned. Shaken with a drop of grenadine. Top Gun soundtrack must be audible to consume. Moments of remembrance appreciated. That one actually sounds the best of the ones of these so far, even though if I tried to drink that today, my stomach would completely reject it. From Ohio State beat reporter Bill Landis of The Athletic, knew a guy who mixed Twisted Tea and Four Loko back when it was basically liquid cocaine. He called it a twist and shout. That is incredible. I don't have anything to add to that. That is just an amazing name for a drink, even though that drink will kill you to the point where it's not even legal anymore. From David Bixler, I don't remember the name of this monstrosity my friend used to make, but it was Everclear Bacardi Raz, I think. Sprite Pink Lemonade Concentrate and two beers in a giant punch bowl. One, you felt good. Two, put you under. I do not believe the first part of that. from At Savory Loaf, we made vodka tonics mixed with chicken stock. Called it the Chicken Choker.
By the way, this is the one that I saw, and I literally, like, I could not stop myself. I just responded to this guy, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah, what is
it
that?
It was the only possible response. He did clarify it was a one-time thing and also said that it's still, since it happened, that was a totally legitimate response. from at Harmon98, this one made me laugh out loud. The blood clot. Cherry Jell-O and vodka chunk inserted into the beer bong, followed by a beer, guzzle, enjoy. Amazing, incredibly college, horrifying name, all of it's good. From at B. Penfield J, we used to drink Jaeger Pain. It's like a Jaeger bomb, but with champagne instead of Red Bull. I started choking in the middle of reading that, because, Jesus. This one gets in for the name. From David Letka, we would mix Bacardi Dragonberry with Arnold Palmer, called it the Dragon Bender. Tremendous reference to an NBA draft lottery bust. Dan, that's basketball, just so you know.
right.
Let's see. From Jake Hams, equal parts rail vodka, triple sec, whiskey, rum, gin, tequila, apple pucker, and blue curacao poured into a 3-ounce, not 1-ounce shot glass. 3-ounce shot glass filled to the rim, and thus is born the slap of Jesus. That one got just continually more horrifying the more ingredients he listed. And now, sadly, I've actually scrolled up to the ones that I left for later. Okay, actually, only two of them. The first one, which Spencer Hall retweeted, I thought was going to be by far the most horrifying one that we got. This is from at Get24 Maize and Blue. Once my friends filled a garbage can with various clear liquors they bought at the duty free, a few boxes of Franzia and some fruit juice. They put an aquarium bubbler in the bottom of it to keep it from settling into layers. Maybe the most disastrous party I've ever seen. If that doesn't turn your stomach, you have a stronger gut than I do. Good God. But the one that actually took it home, and I had to ask to clarify whether he really meant what he said when he said this, because I did not believe it. But from at my cousin Vinny 83, he says, not me, point of emphasis, not me, rather my brother and his friends, the chest hair, Mohawk vodka, and new motor oil. One of them is a lawyer. And he really means, like, the stuff you put in your car.
That's just, when, yeah.
Doesn't that kill you?
I think so. I'm pretty sure.
I think that
you're not allowed to drink that.
No, the liquor makes you probably puke it up fairly. Like, that makes you probably puke that up fairly fast, so you don't metabolize it.
It's like the only... like, that's the best case scenario here, right?
Yeah.
I guess someone responded motor oil is mostly mineral oil, so that must have just ripped apart their insides. And he responded that he recalled the stories being of shots and probably no second helping. So this was probably very much a, like, one-time thing, but one time is way too many for drinking Mohawk vodka mixed with motor oil. But at least it was fresh motor oil. I have a couple others. Do either of you have any horrific drinking stories before I get into mine?
I can do, so I was, I also went to Michigan, you know, big state school. I was in a frat, so, you know, I was cool and, you know, had friends. One of the cool frats, though, not one of the douchey ones, as everyone always says. But our main, like, signature drink wasn't necessarily all that interesting. But it was Kamchatka, some mixture of Kamchatka, Mountain Dew, and then we actually, you know, to make it more sugary, we didn't even add the juice. We just added in Kool-Aid packets. Which really got straight to the point to, you know, make it more palatable. I was going to share the exact quantities, but I actually got yelled at by one of my frat brothers on Twitter saying, I can't be giving out family recipes.
This is top secret stuff here.
Yeah, exactly. We called it Green Drank, and everyone actually loved it. It was very sweet to drink. I think my freshman year when they still let us have handles, at tailgates, we used to fill up handles with it, and just, like, drink it, like, carry the handle around the tailgate and you know, drink it. There were always dead bees floating in the in the cooler because it was so much sugar. So someone had to, like, be in charge of getting the dead bees out of it. And then I would say the grossest drinking story I have, like, on an individual level, is that one time a couple of friends and I decided that we wanted, like, kind of like alcoholic milkshakes, but we were, you know, when we were living at the frat house, we didn't even have, like, a kitchen or anything, so we're just like, okay, let's go get, Shamrock shakes from McDonald's and pour vodka into them. We did this, I think it was, like, one of, like, the frat nights or whatever we had, I don't know. But it, basically what ended up happening is that the vodka settles to the bottom and, you know, the milkshake just sits on top of it, which we definitely should have known being engineers. what you'll imagine happening is that, you know, I stick my straw in and, you know, take a nice, like, stir it up, obviously, and, like, take a nice gulp expecting, like, you know, a mixture of vodka and milkshake. And just get straight Kamchatka vibe. If you know, like, anything about, like, when you're expecting something else and you just get the full blast of, like, Kamchatka, you know, it was disgusting. That also happened to me one time when I, you know, hungoverly pulled a, you know, Gatorade bottle out of out of my fridge, and it ended up being, like, mostly vodka. Those are honestly, like, the gross drinking stories where you make a drink for the express reason of it being gross. You can at least brace yourself and you know what you're gonna get, but when you get the unexpected stuff, it's like, that's the stuff that makes your skin crawl, in my opinion.
So most of
those are my stories.
Yeah, I mean, I So I did not do, I've not done much mixing of disgusting things in my drinking life. I will say, like, you know, my undergrad university is classified information, so I won't get into that. But not for public consumption on this pod. But I did go to, one of my graduate degrees is from Cambridge over in the UK. And so one of my more, like, pleasant, like, you know, brownout drinking things that was, like, you know, preceded by drinking a lot of port and sherry, which are big, big Cambridge things. Was I had to, like, physically restrain my friend after a formal from jumping into the fountain that's in the center of Trinity College, the, like, famous kind of Hogwartsian old residential college we were part of at Cambridge. And we, like, then, you know, I had to, like, drag him away from it because, like, Lord Byron famously got expelled, like, 300 years ago for swimming in it. And you can still get expelled for swimming in it. But we, I...
Of course, God, This is so fucking preppy.
It's horrible. But I will say that the compromise position, I was like, don't jump in. Like, don't just take your tuxedo off and jump in, because we're, like, in black tie for a formal. I'm like, let's go to my room and we'll change to some basketball shorts and then we'll do it. And we did it, like, surrounded by, like, you know, porters, like, patrolling the perimeter, like, poking our heads up out of the fountain to, like, scan the area. I hope no one from Trinity College is listening to this, because they could probably still revoke my degree. that was a good time.
I don't think the crossover between the Ace Pod and Trinity College is very
strong. No, it's probably not. But anyway, that was a good time.
Right. Also, I do want to say sorry to... I know my dad does listen to this podcast. So, you know, I'll tell him that it ends at a certain point. Or I'll tell him this is the basketball section or something. But if you do make it to this point, Dad... not all that stuff was stuff I made up to, you know, sound cool to my friends on the internet, and not stuff I actually did while you were, you know, paying for my college.
Oh, yeah. No, these are all totally hypothetical stories. being really good friends with somebody who bartends at Scorekeepers gets you into some situations. One thing that they like to do was take any bomb shot and turn it atomic, and turning it atomic generally just meant making it massive. So instead of, say, taking a shot of Jaeger and dropping it into a glass of Red Bull, you take a rocks glass of Jaeger and you drop it into a mini pitcher of Red Bull. So they like to do it more with Irish car bombs than with Jaeger bombs, thankfully, because the Jaeger bombs at that size would, like, make your heartbeat flutter. good God, it was horrifying. On my 21st birthday, my friend was actually bartending that night and could not get out of his shift. So after pre-gaming with a fifth of Jaeger at my apartment, my friends dragged me to Skeeps, where their tradition that I could not talk them out of is to give you pretty much one of two options for the first drink that they hand you, and at least they don't make you pay for it. One is a cement mixer, which I don't remember what the ingredients are, but the whole point of it is it curdles while it's in your mouth. So I passed on that in favor of what they called the Bloody Bum Piss. I tried to look up the ingredients of that, too, because I forgot what shot was dropped into it. Don't search for that on Google. even if you add drink to it, it just thinks you have serious medical problems. Don't search for it. It was I think it might have just been a shot of vodka poured into a Coors Light with some hot sauce. And then this is the key. They microwave it. So it's somewhere between warm and hot. And you have to drink it all in one go, which you got to do anyway because it's just
testing. I mean, there's no way you could take a sip and then keep going.
It's certainly not a sipping drink. That was how my 21st birthday started, how it continued at the bar.
And as nobody knows how it ends.
I was going to say.
We didn't make it to a second location. It was a miracle I did not throw up in the car on the way home as my friends drove me back from Scorekeepers. But what I did in my apartment after that is classified. and one final concoction story, once again involving the bartender, this time off hours. One thing we like to do was kind of do themed, like, you know, if you're watching The Big Lebowski, you drink White Russians. You know, there's certain things like that that you just, you know, some things go together. And we rented whatever remake came out when we were in college of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and decided, you know, my bartender friend decides, okay, we're going to make a drink called the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and we reverse engineered it from there. So the whole goal was to make the drink look like blood. So it involved, I texted him to confirm this today, Southern Comfort, orange juice, cranberry juice, and then to get the color right, some grenadine. And then to top it off, because we were really stupid college students, the last ingredient was to prick your finger and drop a put a drop of blood in your drink to make it the authentic Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was as bad as the remake. It was just not a good drink in general. The flavors did not match. I mean, orange juice and cranberry plus Southern Comfort, it does not go together. We all felt like morons for having
Band-Aids. Like, you've been massacred.
After this. So, in related news, I am over 22 months sober, and I have no regrets. And that's, I think, how we're going to end the podcast for this week. Again, please do not do any of this. Do not drink any of the things we just talked about, particularly not the one with motor oil, especially not the one with motor oil. We are not responsible for what happens when you do that. Consume whatever you consume responsibly this weekend, while hopefully watching hockey instead of the Michigan Rutgers game. I do that as a job. You don't have to do that. Basketball season is soon. We will talk more about that in the future. This has been the A-Spot episode 3.3, brought to you by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. Thank you to Connor and Dan for joining me. Cue the music.